This is Allison Sheridan of the NoSilicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, January 1st, 2017, and this is show number 608. Well, I hope you guys all had a safe and happy holiday. We didn't do as much traveling as usual, so it was kind of peaceful for Steve and me. That's a good thing, because this week we head off to CES. That's the conference formerly known as the Consumer Electronics Show. It's in Las Vegas, and it's exhausting. So we have a really good time, though. We're going to be meeting up with Dave Hamilton and the rest of the Mac Observer gang, and Chuck Joyner will be there as well. I hear Chuck is really, really excited about seeing me. So get ready for a bunch of great interviews with crazy products we find out at CES. When Chit-Chat Across the Pond this week, we're joined by good friend of the show and sometimes host, Alistair Jenks. A while ago, I tricked him into using Affinity Photo, and in this episode, he tricks me into buying Affinity Designer. He explains what the difference is between pixel editors, you know, like Affinity Photo and Adobe Photoshop, and vector-based image programs like Affinity Designer and Adobe's Illustrator. I'm not sure you should listen to this episode, really, because I did spend that $50 to buy Affinity Designer before we even done recording. You can find Chit Chat Across the Pond in your favorite podcatcher of choice. I wanted to give you some feedback I got from the NoSilla Castaways about AirPods. First of all, I asked whether our blind friends could tell me, is there a way to clear the pop-up screen that AirPods show on screen when you're running VoiceOver? I had swiped up, down, right, left. I'd done every combination of fingers I could think of, and I couldn't crack the code on how to get it to go away. Well, Kevin Jones wrote to me on Twitter, and he said, why don't you try pressing the home button? Sure enough, that worked. I also heard from Garth Humphreys. He does a podcast called iBlind Tech. Garth explained that you can just close the AirPods case to get the pop-up to go away. I guess I should have thought of that, since that's how I get it to go away on my iPhone when I can see. Just didn't think of it for some reason. Garth did an episode on iBlind Tech of his first 24 hours hands-on. I listened to it, and he's got a fantastic voice. I did explain to him that his punishment for writing to me was that he needs to do some reviews for the show, because he's just got a voice I could listen to all day. Anyway, in his first 24 hours hands-on, he said there is a lag between when he taps a letter on screen and when he hears the tap, but it wasn't bad at all. He wrote to me about a week or so later, though, of using the AirPods, and he said it's a lot more annoying than he thought it would be. He said it's also not consistent, which I kind of bet is even more annoying. He says that he's found if he's going to do a lot of interacting with the phone, he uses wired headphones. But if he's mostly listening to podcasts or audiobooks, he uses the AirPods. So we're going to talk a little bit more about lag later in the show, but I wanted to keep going with the listener feedback. Listener Jill wrote in with a very interesting observation about AirPods. Remember I talked about how you can only control volume, fast forward, and rewind using Siri, since there are no buttons on the device. She pointed out that Siri only works if you allow access to Siri while the phone is locked. Allowing this can make it easier for a bad actor to get to data on your phone. I actively turned this feature on a while ago because I often want to make a phone call while my phone is in my spy belt when I'm walking, so it hadn't dawned on me that Siri control required you to have the phone unlocked, if you had it set that way. So Jill found an interesting solution. She bought a small and lightweight Bluetooth remote control from Satechi for her iPhone. Now she can leave her phone in her purse, wear the AirPods, but simply slip her hand into her pocket to play, pause, fast forward, and rewind and control volume with the Satechi remote. She doesn't have to open up Siri to her lock screen to do any of this. Jill said that the Satechi remote can only be paired to one device at a time, so it only gives you the illusion of controlling the AirPods, when in fact, it's just controlling the phone. She also said she had no idea how often she fiddled with her audio until she got the remote and noticed how much she enjoyed using it. Jill also compared and contrasted the AirPods to her other Bluetooth headphones. She pointed out that while the initial pairing process is way easier with the AirPods, once they're paired to your devices, the other headphones she has are easier to switch between devices. With AirPods, they stay connected to the last device you use them with. To switch, you have to manually connect to them on a different device. She said that her other headphones will grab whatever device is playing audio as long as they've previously been paired. I have to say, though, this has not been my experience at all. I watch videos on my iPad while I'm at the gym, but I carry my iPhone, closed with the screen locked, on a spy belt while I work out. I would like the iPad audio to go to the headphones. If the last device to play to any Bluetooth headphones was the iPhone, that's where it stays. I always have to manually switch the connection to the Bluetooth headphones, AirPods, or otherwise. It's kind of interesting that we're having different experiences with that, though. Well, Jill mentioned one thing I hadn't really thought about. On iOS, if you swipe up from the bottom of the screen, you get to Control Center. I use this often to play with turning on and off Wi-Fi and to get to the flashlight and camera. But I never swiped to get to the audio controls. I pretty much forgot it was there. But Jill pointed out that you can connect to AirPods directly from that screen. I've been launching settings, going into Bluetooth to connect, which is really tedious. So this can be a great time saver for me. So thanks, Jill, for all your ideas on AirPods and for the tip on the remote control. Now, I have to say that I was really, really angry at my AirPods this week. I went to go out for a walk, but the audio from my podcast selection simply would not play through the AirPods. They made the happy chime sound when I put them in my ears, and in Bluetooth settings, they showed that they were connected, but when I hit play on the podcast, I'd hear nothing. Sometimes the audio would revert back to playing out of the iPhone speakers, but mostly there was just dead silence from the phone, and I could see it was playing. Now, the reason I went way past irritated into full DEFCON anger was that the one job AirPods had was to not be fiddly. That's their whole job. You had one job. Don't be fiddly. I can play way less for fiddly Bluetooth. And in fact, when I went and grabbed my Trex Titanium headphones, they worked just fine. I couldn't believe that I could now no longer count on AirPods to just work. Now, I thought maybe it was a charging issue, so I checked the battery status by flipping open the AirPods case. The green light was lit up, which should mean everything's fine, and on the screen it showed the AirPods themselves were at 98% and the case was at 31%. I put them on the charger anyway, and I went for a walk with the Trex Titaniums. When I came back, the AirPods were fully charged, and guess what? They worked just fine. Now, this is where it gets really interesting. I happened to mention this mess to Bart, and guess what? The exact same thing happened to him, but it happened with his Trex Titanium. At first, he thought it was a battery too with his because charging them fixed the problem the first two times this happened. But the third time it happened to him, he simply gave the Trex a timeout and they healed themselves. He was as happy as I was that we just happened to talk about this because it proves we think that this must be an iOS 10 issue, not something wrong with his headphones or mine. Now, that's better news because it seems likely it's going to get fixed much more quickly, or at least that's what we hope. All right, let's give AirPods a break for just the time being. We're going to talk about audio lag a bit later, but let's change subjects now. When the MacBook and later the MacBook Pro came out with only USB-C, there was a lot of moaning and groaning about dongles, but mixed reactions about the loss of the MagSafe power connector. It was designed to break away if someone hit the cable so your laptop wouldn't go skidding across the table and onto the floor. Some people loved MagSafe, some people didn't. I personally was in the love category. Remember when Steve Jobs introduced MagSafe and his memorable quote was, "You're tired of breaking them and we're tired of fixing them." I was absolutely sold when he said that. Countless times, the MagSafe's connector saved my laptops over the years. I'm on my favorite time. I'll never forget this. I was at my friend Melanie's house and I had my laptop on her desk and I purposely strung the power cable across the room to the outlet on the other side of the door. We worked away for a bit and then her giant labradoodle ran through the doorway. The MagSafe connector popped off my laptop instantly and the Mac didn't budge on the desk. I grabbed the power cable and I showed it to her. I explained how it had just saved my laptop and that I purposely set it up that way in hopes of demonstrating the effectiveness of this cool design. It was a teaching moment, right? But then, while I was very firmly grasping the MagSafe end, her bigger dog, a Great Dane, came barreling through the same doorway. Since I was holding onto one end, the end plugged into the wall outlet was ripped out, bending the pins on the connector. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I was able to bend it back, but it sure wrecked my teaching moment. Anyway, back to 2016. Now, I know it's 2017, but it was 2016 when I first wrote this up for the blog. We've got these swell new laptops, but no MagSafe. The folks at Griffin make really good hardware, so when I saw the break-safe breakaway USB-C power cable, I put it on my Christmas wish list. I would finally have a MagSafe-like connector on my MacBooks. The break-safe cable is a pretty cool idea, but sadly, it fails in execution. On one end, there's a traditional USB-C cable, and the other end is magnetic. The cable comes with a second piece that has a matching magnet on one side and a male USB-C on the other side. Plug that little piece into your laptop and then connect the magnet and you're in business. I connected the cable to my laptop as I just described and I plugged it into power. I then lifted my MacBook Pro up off the desk and immediately the cable's magnet popped right open. So far, so good. Next, I continued to hold the MacBook Pro in my hand while I reconnected the magnet, but it fell right out. Sadly, the cable's magnet cannot hold its own weight. I even tried setting the laptop on the desk and just slightly adjusting the location, and the power cable disconnected. The magnet is not nearly as strong as it needs to be to make this useful. I believe that you'd often find yourself with an uncharged Mac if you use this cable for power. So as much as you might miss the MagSafe connector on the new Mac laptops, don't waste your money on the Griffin BreakSafe USB-C cable. Now, after I posted this, someone, and I wish I could remember who it was, sent me a link to a Kickstarter campaign that just finished that is a little bit better idea. Instead of you having to have a cable that has a magnet on one end and then a magnetic piece, it's a piece that you plug a regular USB-C into and then gives you a double magnet piece. Anyway, I'm not explaining it very well, but it's a small piece, so you can use any USB-C cable you have. Now, they demonstrate trying to pull the magnet apart, and they demonstrate that it actually pulls apart at the same strength that the old MagSafe connectors do. So that might be okay. If it can't hold its own weight, though, that'll maybe make it not true. They didn't have anything in any measurement in that method. Like I said, the Kickstarter just finished, so we can't really buy it yet, but maybe that'll be something to look forward to in the future. Remember, if you're from Germany, the UK, or Canada, you too can help support the show through Amazon. If you go to podfeet.com/funwithflags, you can see the four countries Amazon affiliate buttons that take you right to your own store. There's also a link on the Podfeet homepage to take you to that page if you forget my silly URL. By the way, Germany has been going gangbusters on Amazon lately, so I really want to give a shout out to everybody in Germany who's been helping out. It is amazing. Germany's actually coming in about half of what the entire United States is doing. So you guys are crazy spenders, and I love it. And since it's the beginning of the new year, I want to thank all of the Patreons for all of the patrons of the show who signed up at podfeet.com/Patreon to pledge a small amount to support the podcast. Your generosity is never taken for granted. I mentioned in my AirPods review last week that I did some tests of audio-video syncing for Dave Hamilton. I'm going to review that a little bit and then walk into some more advanced questions that I came up with. David asked me to watch some YouTube videos using the AirPods to see whether the sound was in sync, and the results were very positive. I also found an audio-video sync video. I know that sounds confusing the way I just said it. It's a video that demonstrates audio-video sync. It's really, really cool. It's got a horizontal timeline sliding from left to right with several dots and then a long dash every second. Then there's a ball bouncing on the dash as it goes by, as the timeline kind of goes by, and it makes a click sound right when it hits. The idea is that from the timeline, you can measure how many milliseconds of delay there are between when you see the ball hit and when you hear it hit. I tested the AirPods, and it was spot on with this test as well. Now, bringing this all up again, because with no lag, I was hoping I could use my AirPods to monitor my own voice when doing the live show and while recording Skype calls. I use Audio Hijack from Rogue Amoeba to do the audio piping around. I don't use a mixer, and within that app, I can monitor my own voice. I'll describe the simplest example of how Audio Hijack works to monitor a recording. In Audio Hijack, you build up a flow of audio using bricks on a screen. You always need an input brick and an output brick. So I can drag in a brick of my microphone as the input and the AirPods as the output. If I were really recording, I'd also want to drag in a recorder brick after the headphones monitor, after I do the headphones monitor brick. Does that make sense? All right, so with my wired headphones, there's an ever so slight delay between when I talk and what I hear in my headphones. It's small enough that it's not bothersome. If you've ever heard a long lag between your own speech and hearing it, you'll know that it's very distracting and it actually causes you to slow down your speech, which of course makes it even worse. Audio Hijack has a compensation option for the lag and it works to almost completely eliminate it on my wired headphones. However, when I ran a test on the AirPods with Audio Hijack, the lag was terrible. I didn't have a way to measure it, but it was really, really, really bad. Absolutely unusable. Now, I was baffled why this would be, since according to my earlier tests, the AirPods could play back audio without a lag at all. There was no sync issue to speak of. The folks at Rogue Amoeba are really responsive and brilliant, so I dropped a note to them. I really had two questions, one being whether there was any way to fix the problem, and if there wasn't a fix, could they at least explain to me why these two tests had such different results? Chris Barajas wrote back right away, suggesting that I take a look at Stephen Coyle's tests of Bluetooth headphones to learn about lag. Stephen has been running tests comparing different Bluetooth versus wired headsets, and has actually measured the lag. Stephen cares a lot about latency because he's the author of a fun game for iOS called Tapped. That's T-A-P-T. You try to tap out the rhythm of different songs, and then it gives you a score. If you have a lag between when you tap and what you hear, it kind of sucks the fun out of the game. In his most recent tests, he determined that the lag from the AirPods is worse than any other Bluetooth headphones that he's tested. Stephen is so my people, he even made a spreadsheet of all of his testing results, which he shares, and I've got a link to that in the show notes. He measured the lag on the AirPods as being about 22% worse than the other three Bluetooth headphones he tested. By the way, overall, Bluetooth is about triple the lag of wired headphones. I watched the video Stephen posted at stephencoyle.net/AirPods, where he shows himself both playing Tapped and typing on an iOS keyboard. That's where you can see the problem that Garth Humphreys was talking about when you're typing and you have to listen to when it clicks, and if it's not in sync, it's really annoying. I downloaded Tapped myself, and I tried it, and sure enough, there's a pretty significant lag on the AirPods. Stephen seemed pretty into the topic, so I shot him an email asking for some help understanding why some experiments show a lag and some don't. I asked him if he knew why, if I'm watching a YouTube video, I see and hear no lag, but using Tapped and with my Audio Hijacked experiment, there's clearly a lot of lag. Stephen wrote back right away and had a very good explanation. Here's what he wrote. Hi, Allison. Thanks for getting in touch. There's really a pretty straightforward explanation for this, at least as far as I understand. For media playback, Bluetooth devices will generally not display any apparent lag. This is because the media is predictable. macOS and iOS can calculate that there are X milliseconds of lag, then start the video stream X milliseconds later than the audio stream, and thus the two will appear perfectly in sync. Even if there was a huge delay of multiple seconds in sending an audio stream to a Bluetooth device, as long as the video is delayed by the same amount of time, they will appear in sync. In the test video you linked, all the sounds are all part of a continuous audio stream. Therefore, the system knows when the sounds are coming, and the delay sending audio to the AirPods will be compensated for as I described above. The problems arise when the audio isn't predictable. When you tap on a keyboard button, or in my case, when you play a note and tapped, there's no way for the OS to anticipate that. All it can do is rush to get the audio signal out as quickly as it can, which is the amount of time I talk about my tests. macOS and iOS can't send the audio early because it can't be known in advance when the audio should be played. The same holds true for any other real-time application, like passing audio from an input device to the AirPods. In these circumstances, even 1 to 200 milliseconds can be quite noticeable, and that's why you're noticing a huge lag using Audio Hijack and why you don't notice it during media playback. I hope that clears it up a little. Let me know if you have any more questions about it. Best, Stephen. Well, at first, I was content with Stephen's explanation. I thought it was great. But then I remembered that Steve and I also did an experiment with Skype, where there was also no lag. Skype can't possibly predict when I'm going to speak either and has no way of knowing whether I'm on Bluetooth headphones. So how is it compensating for the lag? I wrote a note with both Stephen and Chris of Rogue Amoeba on distribution. Here's what Stephen explained to me next. Remember, he made a mistake saying, let me know if you have any more questions, because I kept going. Here's what he wrote. I think Skype is exempt from the problem for the same reasons media playback is. Basically, even though the Skype stream is showing events as they happen, it's just presenting an audio-video stream that's sent to you from your husband. So the computer can still calculate the delay between the audio and video, and then artificially delay the video stream by that amount of time, in order that they appear perfectly in sync. While it seems to you like you're seeing live video, you're actually seeing a video feed that's slightly delayed in order to match the audio to your AirPods. Well, that made perfect sense to me. But that brought up another question. If Skype can adjust to make the match, shouldn't Audio Hijack be able to do the same thing? It was time to pester Chris yet again. He had a good answer to that as well. He said, we do try to detect the delays of these Bluetooth devices, but for purposes of syncing with other devices in Airfoil, that's another product of theirs, if you output to the local computer output as well as a Bluetooth headset, you'll notice we delay the local output to match that Bluetooth delay. Well, I wish that there was a way for me to use my AirPods as studio monitors. The next best thing was to gain an understanding of why. I thank Stephen and Chris for the responses. I haven't given up hope on this. I'm trying to convince Chris that Audio Hijack could have a block or a brick with an adjustable slider that speeds up the microphone. It was fun to learn about the subject and really dig into the why. And so thanks to Chris from Rogue Amoeba and Stephen Coyle. It was really fun learning. After I wrote the segment up for the blog about lag, Steve Feinstein made a clarification that I think is important. He pointed out that lag is not the same thing as sync. You can have a lot of lag, but have the audio and video still be in sync. It's interesting to think about. When watching a video, sync is all that matters. But in a conversation, you care about both sync and lag. Thanks for the clarification, Steve. Steve Davidson posted a great question on podfeet.com about my post about the Netgear Nighthawk X8 router that I did quite a while ago. He wrote, "Allison, now that Apple has end-of-life the AirPort Extreme, my device of choice until now, I'm taking another look at the Netgear Nighthawk X8. Your endorsement has to be worth money to Netgear. Besides the obvious reasons to use an Apple access point / router, you know, quality, auto notification of firmware updates, that sort of thing, is the fact that I can plug two USB drives into it via a USB hub, and it provides great Time Machine backup destinations for my home systems. So the big question is, do you know if the Netgear Nighthawk X8's USB ports can support over-the-network Time Machine backups?" Well, this is a great question, Steve, and the short answer is yes, you can do this and it works. Short answers aren't the theme of the No Silla cast, are they? Well, Netgear does have a really, really old how-to on setting up Time Machine to work with the routers, but let's walk through it ourselves. You start by connecting the drive you want to use to your Mac and formatting it appropriately, macOS extended. Then you move it to the router, and using one of the two USB ports, only one of them is USB 3, so pay attention to which one you use, and then when you go back to your Mac, in the left sidebar under Shared, you're going to see a computer called ReadyShare. Connecting ReadyShare will show you all of the logical partitions on that drive, not by their cute Mac name, but by a drive letter like you're on Windows 95. You have to poke around at those drives to figure out which one is the right one. I noticed with one drive I tested that I had a recovery partition showing as a drive letter, so that was pretty cool. Take some sleuthing, but you should be able to crack the code on which one's which. When you ask ReadyShare to reveal what's inside the drives, you will be asked for your router login. The Netgear instructions, also evidently written in 1995, say to enter admin and password for the credentials. I trust that you're going to have changed your password to something a tad more secure than that. Once you've authenticated, it's a simple matter of opening Time Machine and pointing it to the drive letter of the right logical partition, and you're good to go. I did a test of it, but I had to stop it since the drive I was testing with was far smaller than my Mac's current level of data. Now, Steve's question got me thinking that I had a problem that might be solved by essentially the same idea. I have a 3 terabyte spinning hard drive sitting on my desk that I use for doing super duper backups of my MacBook Pro. In the past, I would plug it in when I wanted to run a backup. But now that I have the Belkin dock with all those lovely USB ports on the back, I plug the drive into it and it's always accessible so I can have backups run automatically. Now that's all fine and dandy, except for how annoying it is. I have partitioned this drive into 3 1-terabyte drives. That means that every time I want to move my MacBook Pro, it is a laptop after all, I have to unmount 3 drives. Even with a tool like Mountain from aptineers.de that lets you unmount all connected drives and put the machine to sleep, a 7200 RPM drive unmounting 3 partitions takes pretty much forever. I'm talking like a whole minute. I don't have that kind of time. I was also having problems with them being indexed by Spotlight, so when I'd launch an app, it would launch from one of those drives. I fixed that with Steven Getz's help, but it still bugged me having to have them there all the time. Since I knew Time Machine worked great as a network-attached device, I thought it'd be swell to do my super-duper backups the same way as what Steve was trying to do with Time Machine. Now, for those of you who are yelling into the auto players, reminding me that I already have not one but 2 network-attached storage devices in my Drobo 5N and FS, I know that, but still, this sounded like fun to figure out if it would work. The end of the experiment will be relevant to that scenario as well. With SuperDuper, you can only back up to a direct-attached drive or to a disk image. If you select disk image, it offers to make a read-write sparse bundle on a drive of your choosing. Sparse bundles are cool because they actually grow to the size required. This means that you don't have wasted space on the drive just in case. You don't say, I need a terabyte, so I'm going to dedicate a terabyte forever. You can be using 500 megabytes at first and grow into a terabyte. Now, I suppose you do have to be careful not to create something that grows out of control. I set up a sparse bundle on my 7200 RPM drive, and I started up SuperDuper. Worked great, except that it took forever. And I don't mean the 1 minute, full minute kind of forever. I mean the days and days and days kind of forever, like the weeks and weeks kind of forever. I let it run as long as I could stand it, and I finally gave up because I thought I might not live as long as it was going to take. I did some math and never did figure out what was taking so long. The disk write speed is nothing to write home about, but it didn't take weeks to back up to it the first time around when it was sitting on my desk, and the network is gigabit Ethernet, the drive is USB 3, and so is the port it's connected to. So, like I said, I have no idea why this was so slow. Now, if I were a real scientist, I would have direct attached the drive and written to the sparse bundle locally for comparison, and then moved it over for incremental backups. Instead, I had a better idea. Last year, I bought a 1 terabyte external SSD to offload my giant photo library from my internal drive. Now that I have a 2 terabyte internal drive in the new MacBook Pro, I brought my photos back inside. That meant that that 1 terabyte SSD was available as a backup drive. I plugged it into the Belkin on my desk, and I set it up as my local backup drive. Now, I still have to eject it before I dash away, but since it's an SSD, it only takes a couple of seconds to unmount. It also takes up nearly zero space on my desk. It's like the size of a credit card. It's a tiny little thing. You could lose it. Another advantage, I had to set the old drive on a washcloth to dampen the hum of the spinning drive so you wouldn't hear it in these audio recordings. The other thing is, it's only one partition. It's not quite what I was hoping for, but it works well for my purposes. Now, if I could just figure out what's wrong with my crash plan backups. Well, Steve Feinstein also had a point on the blog about this article as well. He wanted me to acknowledge that we don't actually know that Apple has abandoned the wireless router market. All we have is one reputable reporter citing unnamed sources who told him that Apple disbanded the AirPort team. I do appreciate the clarification here because it's important to separate what's real news and what's conjecture. It's not actually rumor, it's conjecture, I think. We're definitely reading tea leaves here. It does seem to match with what we can observe, though. Apple hasn't come out with anything new and interesting in a few years, and they're falling seriously behind in meeting our needs as a result. They don't have any kind of mesh offering. You know, there's no activity going on. Steve called himself a pendant with too much time in his hands. But at the risk of encouraging that behavior, I'm going to thank him for contributing these thoughts. Well, that's going to wind us up for this week. Do not forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions. You can email me at allison@podfeet.com. Follow me on Twitter at podfeet. And remember, everything good starts with podfeet.com. We got podfeet.com/Patreon, podfeet.com/Facebook, podfeet.com/Google+, podfeet.com/Amazon, podfeet.com/funwithflags. And if you want to join in the fun of the live show, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic Nocilla Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.